From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Theoretical physicists sure know how to have fun. These days they talk in all seriousness about multiple universes, quantum entanglement, even time travel. But if you want to see some serious squabbling in the physics department, try mentioning the anthropic principle.
The universe looks not just beautiful, not just intriguing, but in some sense deeply ingenious. The laws of physics seem to be just right for life.
So was the universe designed for life? Today we'll hear from the eminent cosmologist Paul Davies. He speculates that the act of observing reality actually helped shape the laws of physics billions of years earlier. Okay, that's pretty weird. But what about science fiction? Should we believe the science here?
For any event, there is an infinite number of possible outcomes. Our choices determine which outcomes will follow. But there is a theory in quantum physics that all possibilities that can happen do happen in alternate quantum realities.
And somehow I have been shifting from one reality to another.
That is correct.
But first, a man who's trying to build a time machine. Now, I should say, Ron Mallett is no crackpot. He's a theoretical physicist at the University of Connecticut, who's published many papers in professional journals. And I might add, he's also one of the few black physicists around. Mallett has just written a book called Time Traveler. It's the story of his very personal quest to figure out a way to go back in time. And Strange Champs wanted to know more.
When did you first become interested in time travel?
It was actually when I was 10 years old. My father, he was a wonderful person. And for me, the sun rose and set on him. But no one knew just how ill he was. He looked like a very robust person. And he died suddenly of a heart attack. He was only 33 years old. Mm. And it completely destroyed my world. And I went from being a rather happy kid to rather depressed kid. But one of the gifts that he left me was a love for reading. And shortly after he died, I came across H.G. Wells' book, The Time Machine. It was like, oh, wow, this is it. This is the answer. Because I thought if I could build a time machine, then I could see him again. I could go back into the past and see him again.
And actually save his life?
That's right. So that became my holy grail. My goal was to try to build a time machine to see him again and tell him what was going to happen and maybe keep him from dying. So that was actually the beginning of my interest in time travel. The thing that you might say solidified for me, though, was a couple of years later, I came across a popular level book about Einstein. And in that book, it said that time was not something that was absolute. Time could be changed. So that meant to me that what H.G. Wells had said could be true. And so I really knew that this is what I had to do, was to try to understand Einstein so that I could build this time machine.
So how did you wind up becoming a theoretical physicist?
What happened is that when I got out of high school, we were poor. After my father died, the family was very poor, and college was not something that was automatically in the picture. And I knew that if I wanted to go to college, I was going to have to get the money. So I decided to go into the service. So I became an enlisted man in the Air Force, and I worked on electronic computers. And it was actually during that time that I changed, because all of a sudden I realized that it was going to be physics. I actually fell in love with this thing called quantum theory. I mean, people have heard about it, okay? And it said the strange thing that the electron could do, that it could be everywhere and it could pass through walls. And I wanted to know about the people who could do that. And I read that they were theoretical physicists.
So you wound up doing your graduate work and you got your degree and you began moving up the academic ladder as a physicist. What happened to your interest in time travel during those years?
The thing is that even when I was a kid, I knew that people were concerned about me because I was in this depressed state. And so I was astute enough to realize not to tell them that I was wanted to build a time machine, because I didn't want to think about dealing
really
with the consequences
of
that. Exactly. And of course, when I was going up the academic ladder, you know, I thought, if I tell my colleagues I'm interested in building a time machine, right, I'm going to get tenure, forget it.
You know? It's all over. So, but was it something you were still thinking about? Or had progressed so far in physics you'd put the idea of time travel away?
No. See, the thing is that what I did was I developed a cover plan. You have to realize that in physics, physics is a strange, strange beast. There's what people call legitimate crazy ideas, and then there's what people call crazy, crazy ideas. Now, black holes were legitimate crazy. In other words, in black holes, it turns out that black holes are connected with Einstein's work, and black holes are connected with time. I'll explain that. It turns out that a black hole is a star. It's a star that has collapsed to a point where the gravity around the star is so great that all the light that tries to escape from the star gets pulled back to the star. But now, a black hole also does something strange to time. It turns out that if you take a clock, and the closer you get to a black hole, the more time slows down. And if you get near the edge of a black hole, you can actually bring time nearly to a halt. And this slowing down of time actually means that if you understood more about a black hole, you could control time, and that would form a sort of a time machine. So this meant that by studying black holes, I could study about time, and then I could also be considered legitimate crazy.
Well, so during all these years, what kind of progress did you make secretly on the side in your understanding of time?
Well, the thing is that if you look at black holes, rotating black holes, it turns out that there's a property associated with them that they cause space and time to be dragged around, and that it's a possibility with a rotating black hole of actually finding loops in time that can allow you to go into the past. So I realized that Einstein's theory was the key, that if I understood more about Einstein's theory of gravity, his general theory of relativity, then this might allow me to have a time machine that could go back into the past.
Wait, slow down. So the key to this sounds like it's making a time loop?
How do you make
a time loop?
In a way, you can actually think of space as being like a substance, even though we think of it as being completely empty. In Einstein's theory, you can actually think of it as a substance.
Like fabric.
Like a fabric, that's right. But you could also think of it in a way as being like liquid. And in my work, the key to it was the fact that I thought about what rotating black holes did. They could rotate and they could twist space around them. Let's suppose that you think of empty space as being like coffee in a cup, okay? Mm-hmm. Then you take your spoon and you stir the coffee, it swirls around. Well, a rotating black hole can do that to empty space. It can cause space to swirl around. My breakthrough, which came through much later, was to realize that in Einstein's theory, something else could do that too, and that's light. We don't think of light as having an effect, a gravitational effect, but it does. You might say, well, how am I going to get light to be like rotating black hole or rotating object? Well, suppose that you have a square in front of you, and suppose that you put a mirror at each corner of the square, and suppose you send a light beam, a laser beam, down from one corner of the mirror to the other corner of the mirror. It reflects off the mirror there and goes over to the other corner, reflects off of that mirror, goes up to the other corner, reflects off of that, and then comes back to the original corner. You can see the light beam was going around the square. Mm-hmm. That would create what's known as a circulating light beam. Mm-hmm. Okay, this light beam going around. Now, the space that's within that square will actually get twisted around just like the coffee in a cup. In other words, the circulating laser beam will act like a spoon. The space inside will act like coffee, okay? So the circulating light beam will actually cause that empty space to get swirled around, just like coffee in a cup.
And because Einstein says that space and time are really the same thing or kind of together, then time is swirling too?
Yes, exactly. Normally we think of time as sort of a straight line, okay? Mm-hmm. Where at the bottom of the line, you know, is the past yesterday. The middle of the line is like the present today. And the top of the line is like the future. But if time is getting swirled around, then time can be bent into a loop. That means that you can actually move from the future back into the past.
Is this all... I mean, this is the kind of thing physicists talk about, and it's very, very fun to speculate about and to hear about. But is it pure theory, or could it actually be physically real?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we're looking for funding in order to do that. In other words, I'm a theoretical physicist. I have an experimental colleague. His name is Chandraroy Chowdhury. He's a specialist in lasers at the University of Connecticut. He's a professor of physics. And he became interested in trying to verify my work. And so we've been working closely together, and he has come up with experimental designs to test and prove my theories.
This just sounds amazingly exciting, but how far could you take the practical applications? I mean, let's say you get all your funding, and in fact, you prove that you can send a subatomic particle back a nanosecond in time. Does it mean that we could ever really send people back in time? I mean, getting back to your dream of traveling in time?
You know, we're not trying to do it with people, of course, at this particular stage. That may happen, right? We're trying to prove the principle.
Don't you get caught in an endless time loop?
Now, see, that's precisely the thing that comes up with the notion of time travel, is this fact that if I change something in the present, then I change the future. And there's two things that you have to realize with respect to that, because that leads to the notion of these paradoxes that can occur. You know, the most famous one being the so-called grandfather paradox, which says that suppose a time traveler goes back into the past and they prevent their grandfather from meeting their grandmother somehow. Then if they do that, then their grandparents, of course, don't have their parents.
So then you've wiped yourself out.
Right. And so how did you go back and do that? That's called the grandfather paradox, okay? But there's two different ways in which you can view that. Once again, it comes back to this notion of quantum theory. We cannot predict exactly what's going to happen next in quantum theory. All we can say is what is probably going to happen. One aspect of quantum theory is that if you apply it to the entire universe, it leads to the possibility that there is actually not just simply our universe, but there is actually parallel universes. These other universes look very much like our universe, but they're different. They occur whenever any particular decision is made in our universe. Let me give you an example. Suppose that at lunch today, you were trying to make a decision between whether to have a fish sandwich or cheeseburger. At that particular point, according to quantum theory, there would be a split of the universe. There would be a you that had the cheeseburger and a you that had the fish sandwich. Now, these two universes are real and independent of each other and separate. Now, this doesn't have to do with just simply human decisions. I mean, if you have an electron that has two possible paths, according to this, it takes both paths but in different universes. So this is the notion of parallel universes, that there's a split of the universe into other universes for every decision that has to be made. Now, how does this apply to time travel? Now we go back to this grandfather paradox situation. When the time traveler goes back into the past, at the instant they get back into the past, there's a split in the universe. They arrive in a branch of the universe in which, in fact, they can prevent their grandparents from meeting each other, and their grandparents don't have their parents. They will find themselves, or time traveler will find themselves in a strange universe in which they've never been born, but they will be there. However, remember that when they went back into the past, there was a split. The other universe is the branch that they actually originally came from, and they aren't in that branch, and so they don't affect the past, and that branch leads to the time traveler.
So the time machine actually lets you not just travel in time, but between universes.
Exactly, exactly. And so the upshot is that you can travel back in time and change the past, but the past you change is not the past that you came from. And so there is no paradox here because you're not changing the original universe you came from.
Ron Mallett, talking with Anne Strangechamps. Mallett is a theoretical physicist at the University of Connecticut. His book is called Time Traveler.
Hyperspace.
A poem by Fleda Brown, the poet laureate of Delaware.
Tree trunks seem to keep shrinking all winter, and by mid-March the Elk River's visible in blips from horizon to horizon when the sun's going down. Some things I want, I only get a glimpse of. Coltrane at his gentlest. You can still hear what's harnessed, though. He might be playing Soul Eyes, but it's not just eyes. His sax is opening its mouth like a hole in space. I have the theory of a net laid across as a kind of protection. It is like latitude and longitude, or more abstractly, the warp and woof of belief, the kind of thinking that separates day from night, heaven from earth, and so on. Suppose the universe began as a tear in the fabric of another universe. On a two-dimensional plane, the tear would look like a pushed-out curve, the shape of Coltrane's saxophone. What if there are 10 dimensions, and Coltrane is in the 3 of space and the 1 of time, and the rest are hidden? They might be quivering out there like branches of invisible trees or wormholes in the branches. This is a very religious feeling, beyond belief. Not everything is vertical or horizontal. I keep thinking I should do something instead of just stand here. It is all so beautiful for the few minutes I can see the flat plain of blazing water through the trees and the terrific sun on the brink.
Now, physics seems to pop up pretty often in a lot of your poems. Mm-hmm. Why does this appeal to your poetic sensibility?
Honestly, I think there are few things closer related than poetry and physics. You go back to John Keats, the English poet, able to be in mysteries and doubts and uncertainties without any irritable reaching after fact or reason. Well, okay, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, it's exactly the same thing. You stay in one place and you discover that everything is shifting. No matter where your focus is, it shifts the entire universe as you change your focus. And so I've been reading a lot of science lately because I think it's just the richest mind for poetry that I can think of.
That's fascinating. And it sounds like especially quantum physics because it's so weird.
Yeah, it's so weird. Of course, it's weird. And it's weird. And the interesting thing is poetry is kind of based on looking at the gaps between things, not the things. I mean, if you want things, you go to prose. But poetry gives you the concrete objects, but what you're really looking at is the unsaid things between the gaps. And that's exactly where all of physics is going right now. It turns out matter is just such a small piece of existence that it's almost, you know, minuscule in comparison to everything that we can't see. And so what's more poetic than that?
Could you read another poem for us? And I was thinking about For My Daughter's 40th Birthday.
Here is the epigraph for this poem. Particles that were once connected will, when separated, behave as if still connected, regardless of the distance between them. And that was John Stuart Bell who first understood that. And that's the most peculiar thing I can ever think of. So I was thinking about my daughter, of course. Einstein called it spooky action at a distance. I'm rubbing my nose. And what are you doing now, dear one? What parts are we putting together? I dragged you into this. What age is like, really? I had no idea. Turns out, the present settles into its nest of memories and likes it there, even when it stings. Let me start over. I am walking North Intermediate Lake Road on October 7th, not long till your birthday, sun on spider webs, stop signs of dew and sun, one after the other, strung across stalks, a bloom field of sun changes with their studious lines to the center. Time's turned out to be my subject. It's climbed the ladder of my attention, spinning its internal juices, never using itself up. It hasn't been pushy. It's begun to feel like my best friend. Let me start over. Memory's not as easy as I said. It muscles horribly upwards sometimes, bigger than I am, carrying nasty details in its arms. I keep eating them like a spider, so not everything will come your way. I like to think of you where you are right now, driving kids to school in Massachusetts. I'm walking the lake road in Michigan, watching leaves turn and burn in the eye of time. How dear it is to me, the way it holds you in its sun-dazzled arms as you round a curve and break at the sign, squinting your dozen little wrinkles.
Fleta Brown is Poet Laureate of Delaware. Her books of poetry include Reunion and Breathing In, Breathing Out. She spoke with Steve Paulson. How good is the science in TV sci-fi? Coming up, we'll make our own assessment. We'll also talk about real space travel. If you thought going up in a space shuttle is no big deal, think again.
It's 85% propellant. Your car is 5% propellant. A fighter jet is 35% propellant. The shuttle is 85% gas. And then we light it on fire.
Do the latest findings in physics get you thinking about life's big mysteries? If you'd like to share your thoughts, send us email through our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you.
The engine core is completely inactive.
That's impossible. The Romulans use an artificial quantum singularity as their power source. Once it's activated, it can't be shut down.
Now let's take a closer look.
That is a scene from Star Trek The Next Generation, a TV show that had to figure out how to make spaceships rocket across galaxies at breakneck speed. In fact, science fiction often delves into the complexities of physics, from the nature of space travel to the mysteries of black holes. And it's made Leo Durand wonder just how much he understands about the science in science fiction.
You're learning about physics this hour, but not me. I'm bad at physics, and I blame Star Trek. I'm not ashamed to say I like science fiction, mostly TV shows. Starting in elementary school, I watched Star Trek The Next Generation every week. As a little kid, it was nice to imagine that growing up had a bright future with neon drinks, a holographic playground, and an android who said the darndest things.
I have found that the quantum flux in Worf's cellular RNA extends to the subatomic level. It is asynchronous with normal matter. In essence, Captain, Mr. Worf does not belong in our universe.
What?
I also felt smart watching it, because I got an intro to how time and space worked, even though plain old high school physics escaped me. So, where did sci-fi lead me astray?
As a member of the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers of America, I'd be remiss in telling you, do not get your science from science fiction.
Michael Cassatt is a sci-fi writer, mostly for TV, and a columnist for Sci-Fi Weekly.
You know, that's like the warning on the package. Do not try this at home. You go to science fiction that has a scientific bent. You go there to explore some ideas. Wouldn't it be wonderful if? It's just a branch of fantasy.
As a kid, it's easy to fantasize about a world yet to come. But then again, many things seem possible, even plausible. If there's a chance Santa Claus could exist, couldn't transwarp cores and transporters just as easily?
I've never seen anything like this. There's something in here that looks like a molecular phase inverter.
What's that?
It's supposed to change the structure of matter so it can pass through normal matter and energy.
See, to me that sounded possible, if not now, then at least in the near future. Something that can allow matter, even people, to walk through walls. But even when big words are thrown around, Cassatt says writers aren't worried about scientific fact. They need to get the story right. For example, Cassatt wrote an episode of the show Stargate SG-1, where a couple of spacecraft could leave the Earth's atmosphere without the force of gravity affecting the pilots. Sounds interesting, but even the characters weren't too sure how that worked.
If you don't have the science and the rules of the game worked out before you get to a scene, you're probably in trouble with a science fiction or science fiction story. Is it possible? Are we going faster than light or not? Are we using time travel or not? Those kinds of things. But that said, most of it is still BS.
Does it matter whether sci-fi gets science wrong? I went to Lawrence Krauss, a physicist at Case Western Reserve University. He's written several books, like The Science of Star Trek and Fear of Physics.
Science fiction is telling stories, and I've been on programs with well-known science fiction writers who said, really, the science is secondary. What is most important about science fiction is that it tells a good story. Of course, in general, I'd like them to get the science right, but I don't mind suspending disbelief as long as the plot is good.
Thinking back to many of the episodes, that's about right. The science words were just jargon, but more or less road signs to help me follow the story. But what do they really mean? Here's one episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, and in it, there are these temporal disturbances, which are kind of like invisible bubbles in space. If someone is in one, time can slow or accelerate or stop altogether. But Captain Picard needs to figure out a way to move around without being affected.
Mr. LaForge, what about a subspace force field? Like the one we used on Dividia 2. Could something like that protect us from the effects of the temporal fragment?
Possibly. But we need an awfully sensitive phase discriminator in order to moderate that kind of field.
Is there a real thing called subspace?
No, there isn't. In fact, it's one of the plot devices used by Star Trek, because the problem, of course, is that space is pretty big. So one of the things they invented was subspace, these extra dimensions, an infinite number of extra dimensions, where they can send radio signals and other things that actually sort of take shortcuts through the extra dimension and get back home quickly.
What about a phase discriminator? I don't even know what that means.
Well, that's good that you don't know what it means, because it's invented there to sound good. In Star Trek, it's called technobabble. And that is one of the best examples of technobabble. The words phase and discriminator both mean things. And in fact, in electromagnetic radiation theory, you can talk about the phase of an electromagnetic wave. But in this context, it's just jargon.
If people are getting smarter about physics, though, maybe their knowledge of science is evolving. Are shows getting more realistic then? In one scene from Battlestar Galactica, the new one, not the old one, a nuclear bomb goes off on one of the ships.
Well, actually, when I saw that clip, the first thing that hit me is it's the same problem that Star Trek happens. It's one of the most basic mistakes. The movie Aliens got it right. In space, no one can hear you scream. What you perhaps didn't notice is when you saw the bomb from a great distance, you not only saw the bomb, but you heard it. You heard the boom. But sound is a wave, and it needs some medium to travel in. And in space, there's no air or water, so in fact, you wouldn't hear the boom. But of course, from the point of view of the plot, the boom makes it a lot more effective. And so Gene Roddenberry knew about it, and so did the Battlestar Galactica people.
Then there's the mainstay of space sci-fi shows, a way to travel faster than the speed of light. It's called different things, warp drive, faster than light jump drives. If we can clone animals and see light years out into space, then what's the holdup, NASA? Why no warp engines? Lawrence Krauss.
What's kind of amazing is that in some sense we can show it's not impossible. The laws of general relativity tell us that you can do strange things to space and time. And so while Einstein told us you cannot travel through space faster than the speed of light, space itself can do whatever the heck it wants. And so space can expand and contract faster than the speed of light, and that's happening in the real universe. So if you use that fact, you can sort of be carried along by space like a surfer on a wave.
Is this one of those things years from now we'll be seeing in the real world?
No. Because really the way space expands or contracts is you produce intense gravitational fields. And the kind of energy that would be required to produce these kind of gravitational fields would dwarf anything that we can imagine. In fact, I once showed that if you wanted to warp space in a way that would carry a spacecraft from any region from one place to another, the amount of energy that would be required, even in principle, if it were possible, and we don't know if it would be more than the mass of the entire galaxy.
Is there any way someone like me can hit the reset button and relearn physics the right way? Without this fake baggage from sci-fi?
There's a theory in pedagogy that says that really the best way to have explain something and have someone remember it is to confront their own misconceptions, is to, you know, take something that they absolutely believe and show it's wrong. And boy, when they discover that, they'll really remember it. And the great thing about science fiction is it gives us great lots of examples of things that are wrong.
That's physicist Lawrence Krauss talking with our producer, Leo Durham. Leo also spoke with screenwriter Michael Cassatt. Okay, for a moment, let's forget about warp drive. What is space travel really like? It's the question Chris Jones explores in his book, Too Far From Home. It's partly the story of the space shuttle Columbia that exploded in 2003, and partly a study of just how dangerous space travel actually is.
It's crazy when you actually break it down. I'm not particularly a space guy, or at least I wasn't before I started working on the book. And if someone asked me before if I want to go to space, I would have said sure. If you ask me now, I would say hell no, because the shuttle is this, you know, it's millions of parts. It's made by thousands of people. If any one of those parts or if any one of those people is messed up somewhere along the way, then there's a good chance that seven people are going to die in fire and smoke. And that's just the reality of it. You know, every time people are launched into space, in some ways, it's this minor miracle. And, you know, the space station's only about 250 miles above us. Dallas and Houston are farther apart, but it is quite a divide. It's this chasm, yeah. And to string people across is a pretty tough job.
NASA has made us feel as though space travel can be safe. You start to think about the shuttle, though, and we now know that it can be dangerous. You went through this. I mean, can you tell me about the things that can go wrong with a shuttle?
The list would fill a phone book. You know, for me, one of the great telling little details about how fragile this machine is. Down in Florida, there are little hardware store owls guarding the space shuttle from woodpeckers because woodpeckers have put holes in the external tank before. You know, this is this massive, massive machine that can be brought down by a bird with a pointy beak. It can be brought down if it's cold outside. You know, just a few weeks ago, we realized that if hailstones bang into it, that's a big problem. We've learned, you know, from Challenger that something as simple as an O-ring on a solid rocket booster can take it down. There's this, in some ways, this eternal list of problems.
Somewhere in the book, you describe it as a gas tank with a riding module on it or something like that.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the other thing that we sort of forget is that it's 85% propellant. Your car is 5% propellant. A fighter jet is 35% propellant. The shuttle is 85% gas. And then we light it on fire. In some ways, it's insanity physics. I mean, the other sort of myth is that astronauts are these incredibly, well, and they are incredibly brave, don't get me wrong, but they're not immune to nerves or fear. They're in the cockpit for several hours before launch. And in those moments, they're sweat. You know, one of my favorite stories was a veteran astronaut named Story Musgrave was sitting very quietly in the cockpit while his younger colleagues were chuckling and idle chatter to fill the time. And someone said, "Story, you know, why are you so quiet?" And he said, "Because I'm scared to death." And everyone else just suddenly shut up and went, "Holy moly, this is a big deal." These aren't guys with cowboy hats going yippee-ki-yay. I mean, they're stressing for those final few moments.
Yeah, and they're smart guys. They really are the kind of people who know what can go wrong. I mean, one of the other things that sort of astonished me was thinking about the spacesuits. We think that when they go on a spacewalk, they're linked to the station, and if they were to lose the link, if the tether were to go, that they'd be okay. It's kind of crazy, isn't it? I mean, they could be floating in space forever.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the closest anyone has come to that was a Russian mission, actually, where one guy was floating outside the capsule and the other guy was supposed to stay inside and sort of keep watch. But there's this thing, this phenomenon, you know, they used to call it the call of the waters, where sailors would, for no apparent reason, pitch themselves off the backs of their ships and into the ocean. And the same thing happens in space. And this guy who was inside the capsule decided, "Oh, I'm just going to poke my head out for a look," and was soon adrift. And because he was never supposed to be out there, he had no tether or anything like that. And only at the last second did his colleague sort of grab his foot as he was floating on by. And without that grab, he was done. He was a satellite. And that can still happen today. They do have these sort of nitrogen backpacks that if everything goes right, they can slam themselves back into station. But if they miss station, or if the nitrogen doesn't fire, or some other calamity happens, you know, these guys might have as long as 7 hours before their oxygen runs out, where they can sort of confront their goodbyes.
It tells you an awful lot about who it is and what they're doing. These are the little things that sort of paint the picture. We've seen some of the bigger things, and I gather you have too. I mean, you examined the tragedy of the space shuttle Columbia in 2003. Maybe, I'm not sure we all remember. What was the mission?
It was the last scheduled purely scientific mission for shuttle. Every other shuttle launch, and this is still the case today, is going to space station to bring something to space station, a part or to add a module. Columbia was science. And in fact, that launch had been bumped several times in favor of missions that were considered more important. So these seven people who ultimately were lost had repeatedly been bumped to the back of the line. And when they finally launched, I imagine for them it was sort of this vindication, and little did they know that not long later they would lose their lives for it.
Well, they did accomplish everything they set out to accomplish, and then they turned around to come home, and it exploded. What happened?
Well, at launch, a piece of foam, there's sort of this insulating foam on the external tank. This foam had come off during most launches and had bounced harmlessly off the shuttle. And in this particular instance, it had happened to hit a very small panel on the front of the left wing, the leading edge of the left wing, and put a hole into it. And there were suspicions that this impact had occurred, but the wisdom on the ground was that the foam was never powerful enough to knock a hole into it. But as it turns out, in this particular instance, it was. It was total fluke, very bad luck that this particular shuttle had this particular spot hit by this particular chunk of foam. A lot had to happen for this to happen. But that left an opening. And the heat of reentry, I don't know if you can picture it in your mind, but you see the shuttle returning and it's surrounded by fire. Well, that fire got through that hole and started to melt the internal structure of the shuttle from the inside out. And it kind of collapsed in on itself.
I think a lot of people remember seeing that fire, and it grew in the way that we expected it to. And then all of a sudden it was much more than that.
Yeah, all of a sudden, you know, instead of one streak across the sky, there were several. And it wasn't that long after before parts of Columbia started raining down and we saw those horrific images of an astronaut's helmet lying on the grass or a piece of the engine block falling into a golf course.
Of course, the other thing that happens is that those are the images that are left in our mind, and we've all, I think, forgotten that there were three astronauts still in space. But the thing that is astonishing when you think about it is that they didn't have any way home. There wasn't another shuttle to go get them. We always think that somehow, you know, in the Heinlein novels, there's always another rocket ship out there that can come pick you up. But that's not the stage we're in space travel, is it?
No, there are only so many ways. There's the shuttle, and initially there was the idea that we could send another shuttle up to get them. And then when the problem of the foam sort of surfaced and NASA realized how many bullets they had dodged, you know, over the history of the program, and that there was a recognition that if they lost another shuttle, if they lost a third out of five, that NASA would probably get its plug pulled. You know, the idea of just sending up another shuttle was scrapped pretty quickly.
Then on the other hand, you've got three guys up there and you've got to go get them. I mean, you can't let them just sit there until the air runs out.
Well, except that the idea was that we will have them sit there. they called them up and said, guys, you might be up there for a year, maybe 2 years. And these are guys with wives and children and lives on Earth. Again, it was part of that moment. They lose Columbia, they lose their seven friends, and there's a sadness from that. But very shortly thereafter, there was that, how are we going to get home? The only other option is this antiquated Russian rocket called the Soyuz, which NASA was very reluctant to use, apart from reasons of pride. It's this old, messy piece of technology. But finally, they did come to the understanding that we can't leave these guys up here. All of a sudden, these guys found themselves strapping into a Soyuz capsule and pressing a button that sent them on their way back to Earth.
Wow. You know, after all this, they're still talking about other space missions. There are people who are talking about going to Mars, which is an extended space mission for people. What kind of obstacles do they face in contemplating a thing like that?
For someone like me, the fascinating thing are the human limits that they'll confront. I mean, there are people who obsess about the machines, the propulsion systems, or how will we land on the surface of Mars? How will we get back off the surface of Mars? And those are all fascinating. But for me, you know, the questions are, what kind of people will want to go away for 2 years? What kind of people will want to live on another planet? You know, the astronauts go through this rigorous physical testing, and they are elite machines as human beings in a lot of ways. There's a little over 100 of them. Only 25 of them are qualified to go on a long-duration mission because something very simple in their medical background, a heart murmur when they're pushed to 95% capacity, will scratch them from that list. Because your body undergoes changes. Your muscles atrophy. The muscles that we use to get out of bed in the morning or to climb into our cars, they're not using. Your bones start to decay. You can start getting things like kidney stones and calcium deposits. Your spine lengthens as much as an inch, so you can get back aches and so on. Your sinuses are filled with fluid because gravity isn't drawing them down. You know, there's this list of ways that weightlessness affect our bodies, because our bodies were designed for gravity. But then there are the psychological issues, and the longer these people spend up there, the more we learn how to keep them content. And in some ways, their assignment is learn how to be happy. What is it that makes you happy up there?
What have they discovered so far? I mean, what does make them happy?
It can be very mundane things in some ways. You know, they decided that the idea of having dinner sitting down at a table is important. It makes you less homesick. So they have a table where you can sit down, you strap yourself down, and you're sitting like you do on Earth. Music is very important. There's a supply of music up there. There's stereos and headphones, little connections to life on Earth. There's email, there's internet, there's a satellite phone, there's video conferences. Those are all very important. And then it's like weird little material things. There's a guitar up there. There's a Casio keyboard up there. There's a football up there. There's all these things that sort of help people feel more at home, even though they're floating in this tin can in the middle of this abyss.
Chris Jones is a writer for Esquire magazine. His book is called Too Far From Home. Coming up, why are the laws of physics just right for life? I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. Many scientists marvel at how the laws of physics seem finely tuned for life. For instance, if gravity were just a little bit stronger, stars would burn out too quickly for planets to form and for life to evolve. If gravity were just slightly weaker, red giant stars would never produce the fusion needed to form the heavier atoms necessary for life. Likewise, if the strong nuclear force were just a bit stronger, protons and neutrons couldn't bind together to form hydrogen, or water, the elixir of life. And so on. There are, literally, dozens of laws of physics that have to be just right for life even to be possible. Some scientists call this the anthropic principle. It's an idea that British cosmologist Paul Davies explores in his book Cosmic Jackpot. He told Steve Paulson that we simply cannot dismiss this cosmic fine-tuning as a lucky fluke.
All my career I've been fascinated by the fact that the universe looks not just beautiful, not just intriguing, but in some sense deeply ingenious. The laws of physics seem to be just right for life.
And you're suggesting that it seems to be more than just coincidence that they are just right.
That's right. I think to just shrug this aside and say, well, if it wasn't that way, we wouldn't be here, would we, is no answer to the question. It's just choosing to sweep it under the carpet.
But that is the most common response of scientists, that it's just a lucky fluke that we're here, that all
right.
of these physical laws happen to be just so, and so that carbon could be formed, the Earth could develop, human beings could arise. We happen to be here to be able to see all of that, but there's no inherent reason for any of that.
I think you're absolutely right that most scientists would say, well, that's it, it's a lucky fluke, and if it hadn't happened, we wouldn't be here, and so we won't bother to ask what's going on. Now, that point of view might have been tenable 20 years ago when the laws of physics were simply regarded as just there, just sort of God-given or existing for no reason. It wasn't the job of the scientist to ask why those laws or where did the laws come from. But increasingly over the last 20 years, with the search for the final unification of physics, there's been more and more of a thrust towards saying, well, we won't just accept the laws of physics as given. We'll ask, how did those laws come to be? Are they the ultimate set of laws? We suppose they were just magically imprinted on the universe at the moment of the Big Bang for no particular reason, and that the form they have has no explanation.
There are different versions of the anthropic principle. Can you briefly lay those out for us?
Yes, people often talk about the weak, the strong, and the final anthropic principles. The weak anthropic principle, nobody could really object to. It just says that the laws and conditions of the universe must be consistent with life. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. Now, the weak anthropic principle on its own doesn't tell us very much, but if we combine it with a multiverse hypothesis, then we're in business. Now, the multiverse hypothesis says what we've been calling the universe all along is nothing of the kind. It's just a bubble, a little local region in a much vaster and more elaborate system called the multiverse. And the multiverse consists of lots of universes. There are different ways you can arrange this, but one way is to have them scattered throughout space. And each universe would be a gigantic bubble, much bigger than the size of what we can see at the moment. But there would be many, many bubbles, and each of these bubbles would come with their own set of laws.
Just so I understand this, I mean, all those what are assumed to be billions of galaxies in our universe, that's still just one universe. And in this theory, there would be many such universes like this.
Everything else, as far as our most powerful instruments can penetrate, would belong to just one universe, this universe. I'd like to call this a Hubble bubble. So we're talking about a distance of, you know, out to nearly 14 billion light years. But eventually, if you travel far enough in any direction, you would reach the edge of that bubble, and then there'd be a chasm of exceedingly rapidly expanding space, and then you'd come to another bubble. And then you would find that only in a tiny, tiny fraction of those bubbles would all the conditions be right so that there can be life. And of course, it's no surprise we find ourselves living in such a life-encouraging bubble because we couldn't live in any of the others.
What is the strong anthropic principle, which is far more controversial?
The strong anthropic principle says that there is, in some sense, an element of compulsion, that the universe must bring forth life and observers at some stage. So even if there's only one universe, it must be the case that this universe will end up being observed by beings such as ourselves. Now, that's much harder for scientists to swallow because it seems to turn everything upside down. It gives mind and consciousness a central place in the great scheme of things.
Well, it also sounds fairly religious. I mean, let's face it, the standard explanation for how all of this happened was God did it. God set this in motion so that human beings could eventually evolve.
Right. So you could give this either both a religious or an anti-religious interpretation. The religious interpretation is that God made the universe just as it is in order that life and conscious beings may emerge. The other way, which I suppose would be anti-religious, is to say that in some manner the emergence of life and observers causes the universe to have the laws that it does. Now that, when I say puts the cart before the horse, that is pretty much literally, from the causal sense, what I mean. It makes the emergence of life and observers later on in the universe have some responsibility for the way the laws come into being at the beginning.
Is this what John Wheeler, the famous physicist, talked about when he made the case for a participatory universe?
Yes. So now we're into another version, another variant of this anthropic principle, which is sometimes called the participatory or even the final anthropic principle, where somehow the emergence of life and, in particular, observers link back to the early universe and ensure that the laws of physics and the initial conditions are such that observers emerge. Now, this has some appeal, and the reason it has some appeal is because the conventional theistic explanation of the universe and the conventional scientific explanation of the universe both suffer from the same shortcoming, in my view, which is that they attempt to explain the universe by appealing to something outside it. In the case of the religious explanation, appeal is made to an unexplained God who simply has to be there in order that the universe should be created with the form it has. In the case of the scientific explanation, the laws of physics just happily exist for no particular reason, and they just happen to have exactly the right properties, but it's all unexplained, and it's all pushed off to outside of the universe totally. What appeals to me about John Wheeler's idea is that it attempts to provide an explanation for the biofriendliness of the universe from entirely within it. Now, the difficult point about all this is we have to explain how the existence of life today can have any effect on the laws that the universe emerged with at the time of the Big Bang.
Right. I mean, this sounds like it's coming right out of science fiction here, that somehow future people can go back in time and have something to do with the creation of the universe. It's pretty far-fetched.
It is pretty far-fetched until you stop to think that there is nothing in the laws of physics that singles out one direction of time over another. The laws of physics work forward in time and work backward in time equally well. But the particular mechanism that Wheeler had in mind has to do with quantum physics. Now, quantum physics is based on Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. This uncertainty principle works both ways in time. There's no doubt about this. That is to say that if we make an observation of an atom in a certain state now, then its past is uncertain, just as its future is uncertain. And so one way of thinking about that is that the present state of the universe, which of course includes observers by definition, we're here, there will be many past histories that will lead up to this point. And so what this means is that there is an element in which observations made here and now have an effect not only in the future but in the past. It's possible to do experiments in the lab to demonstrate this. You can't use it to send signals back in time. You can't send information back into the past. But the nature of the quantum state in the past cannot be separated from the nature of the quantum state in the present.
So you're saying this is just through the act of observation itself. I mean, through the fact, for instance, that human beings are aware, you know, have intelligence and are aware of the universe. I mean, that in itself might, through some weird mechanism of quantum physics, be able to explain this. I mean, you're not talking about super smart creatures in the far future who go back and somehow fiddle with the laws of physics to create the Big Bang.
Right. But I'm not talking about time travel. There have been various science fiction and serious science speculations about that type of gerrymandering with the universe, that some super civilization goes back in time and fixes things up to make a self-consistent loop. No, this is just standard quantum physics. Standard quantum physics says that if you make an observation of something today, and it might just be the position of an atom, then there's an uncertainty about what that atom is going to do in the future. There's an uncertainty about what it's going to do in the past. Einstein called this spooky action at a distance. What I'm suggesting, this is the radical departure, is that the laws of physics themselves are subject to the same quantum uncertainty, so that an observation performed today will select not only a number of histories from an infinite number of possible past histories, but will select a subset of the laws of physics which are consistent with the emergence of life. And that's the radical departure. It's not the backward in time aspect, which has been established by experiment, and there's really no doubt that quantum mechanics opens the way to linking future with past in that manner. It's that it's suggesting we extend those notions from the state of the universe to the underlying laws of physics themselves. That's the radical step.
Just so I'm clear on what you're saying, I mean, you're saying that somehow built into the very origins of the universe, I mean, if you go back to those first few seconds, somehow the laws were put in place so that intelligent life would arise billions of years later? Am I right about that?
Well, you could be wrong if what you're suggesting is that therefore there exists an intelligent designer who figured it all out and created the universe with a set of laws that would bring intelligent beings into existence. That's not what I'm saying.
You want to stay away from the God word.
I want to stay away from a pre-existing cosmic magician who is there within time for all eternity and then brings the universe into being as part of a preconceived plan, because I think that's just a naive, silly idea that doesn't fit the theological leanings of most theologians these days and doesn't fit the scientific facts. I don't want that. That's a horrible idea. But I see no reason why there can't be a teleological component in the universe that is part of the evolution of the universe, includes things like meaning and purpose, and that the laws of physics which we've been discussing are weirdly bio-friendly need an explanation for that, and that explanation could be connected to the very existence of beings. So I'm talking about a self-synthesizing, self-explaining universe in which the existence of life and observers arising billions of years after the Big Bang have some effect on the nature of the laws that emerge from the Big Bang through the various sorts of causal loops that we've been talking about.
Cosmologist Paul Davies talked with Steve Paulson about his book Cosmic Jackpot. Davies has received numerous awards, including the Templeton Prize and the Faraday Prize from the Royal Society in London. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. Send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Frontiers of Physics, number 415A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.